a significantly lower civilian death toll, as the United States has pushed for, not so much out of concern for Palestinian lives as out of fears of a broader regional war and damage to international support for Washington and Tel Aviv. The Zionist regime has instead escalated its attacks since the brief November truce. It is beyond doubt that the Zionist regime has already committed a series of war crimes. This is not surprising for a regime that has for decades developed and cultivated that habit, and even less so when one remembers that Israel was founded on ethnic cleansing, war crimes, discrimination against non-Jews, and contempt for international law have been major parts of the Zionist regime's DNA since its creation in 1948 and even before. But there is now debate over whether the Zionist regime's massacres have reached the level of genocide in the legal sense of the term. According to Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Killing members of the group, causing them serious bodily or mental harm, deliberately inflicting conditions of life aiming to bring about the group's destruction, imposing measures intended to prevent death, or forcibly transferring children to another group. The Zionist regime's actions in Gaza and their horrific consequences on the entire civilian population, alongside their repeated declarations of Israeli regime officials that strongly suggest deliberate intent to wipe out, or at least harm, as many Palestinians as possible, leave little doubt that the bar has been reached and long since surpassed. Many officials, journalists, and members of civil society have publicly called this a genocide. Despite some reservations, a consensus seems to be emerging among academics, legal scholars, and even former International Criminal Court prosecutors who can certainly recognize a genocide when it is unfolding before their eyes. History has taught us there are many ways to exterminate a group of people or depopulate a population, but the Zionist regime's campaign of genocide, ongoing since 1948, is defined by several characteristics. Its permanent nature, the variation between slow-motion genocide and waves of brutal slaughter, and the rich array of techniques of mass death. In the current moment, Israel is systematically combining all those methods of death with horrific results. One can identify at least 8 genocidal techniques that have converged in the regime's reaction to the October 7th events. It appears that the Zionist regime seized this opportunity to take its slow-motion genocide to a whole new level of brutality. Number 1. Kill them. Bomb Palestinians indiscriminately. Here, media attention, pressure from allies such as the U.S., and international protest can have a certain effectiveness in restraining Israel. Despite the Zionist regime's assertions that it is taking measures to protect civilians, the realities on the ground show otherwise, with non-combatants forming the bulk of the casualties. Schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings have been directly targeted. Number 2. Starve them. This is being done through blockades of food and water supplies. Again, this is nothing new. It has long been part of a concerted and organized Israeli policy to deprive Palestinians of even the most fundamental of all life-sustaining resources, and water. Number three, strip them of medical care. The Zionist regime is maximizing the casualty count by destroying medical infrastructure, including hospitals, thus ensuring that many who might have been saved will instead die from untreated injuries. Number four, spread disease among them. The collapse of medical infrastructure, along with catastrophic living conditions, has guaranteed the spread of disease, risking another significant wave of death. Number five, exhaust them through forced evictions. Taking a page from the American genocide, the Zionist regime is now using forced relocation, first from Gaza's north to the south, then within the south, to make exhausted and often injured people move from one safe area to the next. A grid map published by Israel has divided southern Gaza into hundreds of tiny parcels, between which people are being forced to move at short notice to avoid bombs. Number six, destroy their environment. What is happening in Gaza is a veritable ecocide. The amount of environmental destruction through everything from durable pollution to military ammunition is enormous and could affect future generations. Number seven, atomize their society. The systematic destruction of governmental and administrative structures under the pretext of fighting resistance movements has upended Palestinian society. By displacing the majority of Gaza's 2.3 million people, the Zionist regime is severing their social links. It is unclear how they will be able to recreate a society in the future, especially as the Zionist regime has tried to tie all civilians to resistance groups and intends to maintain control over the territory and its resources for the foreseeable future. And number eight, break their spirit. For decades, the Zionist regime has used psychological warfare to foster a sense of despair and helplessness among the population. This has been terribly effective among the most vulnerable, Gaza's children, many of whom suffered from severe desperation and suicidal thoughts even before the current offensive. Given that the fabricated regime of Israel also makes it nearly impossible for them to be treated, most will suffer long-term trauma. The eight methods are all forms of collective punishment, with consequences bound to last for at least a generation, even if the war were to end today.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I'm Umebiha Mukhtar, your host on IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. Joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher, and she will enlighten us on the concept of hijab as guided by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
What are his evidence, Ayatollah Khamenei's views of why the hijab is made compulsory in the Iranian society?
Actually, when we say Iranian society, we mean Islamic society.
Okay.
Because the Iranian now society is not just the old-time Irani Mastani system.
It's
a revolution that was created based on the Islamic system that Imam Khomeini rose up to want to prepare for the reappearance of Imam Zamana, that this nation should at least be a step forward to show their diligence, that they are going, they are practicing the Islamic rule that Imam Zamana wants to lay in its all perfection.
True.
So it's a starting point, right? So it's not only the Iranian society, it's Iran wants all based on Islam and its principles. And that also principles that I got from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned in what? Quran and Ahadith. You see, the West, Ayatollah Khamenei says that the West, this unbound relation between men and women are very common. So absence of a modest clothing, you know, or a mediator is normal for them. So he says, I don't mean to say that in Western countries all men and women are corrupt. No. You see, he's talking with justice here, Ayatollah Khamenei. He's just saying that everything is wrong. All of you are like that. No. I wouldn't make such accusations, he said. And this is not true, of course. Surely, there are also chaste good men and women among them, the righteous people with virtues. So usually, you know, when Ayatollah Khamenei speaks about this, it's mostly based on what the people, the government does.
Yeah.
It's not the people, you see. So he wants to say that, reiterate that there are good people, there are virtuous people. Really people, they want to be good, you know. They want a change in their lives.
That's why he had written that whole letter for you to the youth of the West. And he had written such beautiful things. Just to show that he also is thinking about them. They're important for him.
Yeah, they're important for them. It's like they're also his children.
Yeah.
You know? However, he says, the sexual freedom dominates Western societies, unfortunately. This is a mixing of men and women. And it's a major part of Western culture. You know?
Yeah.
A major part that this is very considered, very like stylish, very, you know, smart and very sophisticated. In Western culture, freedom of sexual desire is permitted. And in some cases, unfortunately, unlimited. Why? Because they have the audacity and the, you know, permission to also build buildings like where there are things going on that are so, you know, filled with vulgar things like discos, you know, alcoholic drinks.
Casinos. All things to kind of, you know, take you away from what
Uncle, right?
Is,
to just drive your uncle down.
And that's how, like, I think we had mentioned once in one of these episodes that this is how they control the society. This is how, you know, they don't let them go further in terms of their spirituality. Yeah. This all is kind of a blockage, So, inshallah. So, let's just take a brief intermission and we'll be back.
Thank you.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and we've been discussing about what Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab is, and you told us that in fact this was not the Iranian society as such, it's, we're talking about the Islamic society. The Iranian society is now the Islamic society, which in fact we should be proud of, you know.
Yeah.
And we've been discussing about how the Western ideologies kind of come and limit this progress, especially in terms of our spirituality.
Yeah. He first discusses about how the Western has no limitations between the men and women and allows freely mixing. So he says that some Western countries are so deeply submerged in this area of this freedom between men and women and this deviance, and they've transformed their lives in such embarrassing ways. If you go and see now, it's been institutionalized, you know, like gay and lesbianism. It's all like LGBT or everything is so institutionalized that they find, you know, and if you go and see even there, people find it still strange. The people who are, you know, like they have good morals, their hearts are pure, even if they're Christians, and they believe in proper marriage of man and woman, but they find it too strange that why is this happening? And somehow you see a distance when you see, you know, their children getting involved in such nonsense. Yeah. So there are so embarrassing ways for them also.
And also the irony that that is, you know, that is okay for us to include and be inclusive to such kind of groups of people, but it's so hard for them to be inclusive to women with hijab.
Yes.
So it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. And of course, they later regret it. This is what Ayatollah Khamenei says. This is something that Western thinkers, politicians, and policymakers cannot resolve. How they cannot resolve? That means they're seeing that such things are giving rise to corruption, embarrassment, diseases. It's that they feel like, what do they do? The youth want it. Why? It's because of their wrong policies. What are these wrong policies based on? They are based on un-Islamic principles. True. And based on their own cultures and biased views, okay? So they cannot resolve now the policymakers, and it has become a big problem for themselves. The West also exported this culture, behavior, and a harmful habit to all the countries, Ayatollah Khamenei says. This corruption did not exist in other countries first. In Muslim countries, even in non-Muslim Eastern countries, such things like this freedom of mixing gatherings, like sexual freedom, did not exist. It was just imported from the West. If you go see Indians, okay, Indians were very respectful first.
Yeah.
Although they were Hindus, they were not Islamic, they did have Islam, but they had that shame.
That
but now if you go and see, that shame has gone away. Importing the Western ideas. So they exported these ideas. Those people, ignorant people, took the ideas with both hands. Why? Puppets.
Yeah, very true. We're just going to go on a short break and we'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we were discussing Ayatollah Khamenei's views of the hijab and why it's made compulsory on the Iranian society. And we were discussing about how the Western ideologies are kind of so corrupt, and we are kind of looking them as the ideal to follow. But they have brought in homosexuality and, you know, this free mixing, while in the past we had so much piety, purity, and, you know, they were shameful. They didn't like showing off their bodies. But now, because everyone's trying to adopt the Western culture that seems the most appropriate, we all want to be like them for some reason, which is unfortunate.
He was also saying about how these things did not exist and they were imported, you know, from the West. So they did not exist. There were a lot of, you know, like modesty in their natures, like some nations, there was a lot of modesty in them. But now, what with this influence, you know, of the West, they even got this in their culture. So now, Ayatollah Khamenei says, who stood up? See, he's proud of the former Islamic leader also. Who stood up? The Islamic revolution and revolutionary leader, Imam Khomeini, resisted this corruption. and announced from its beginning. That's very important.
Yeah.
That he did not accept this unbound relations between men and women. It believes in the necessity of a modest appearance and Islamic-based relations between men and women. The Islamic Republic insisted on this way of life. Some people think that this is an unimportant, trivial issue.
True.
But they are at best wrong. This is an important, extremely important, that too, a matter. Then he says, I should tell you here that one of the main reasons for Western animosity towards the Islamic revolution has to do with this matter, that is the hijab, unlimited sexual behavior. We don't allow it, they allow it.
Yeah.
They feel, you know, what is wrong with it?
Yeah.
Why are these people resisting? Then he says, they are extremely defensive over this issue. If the Islamic Republic had been less strict solely on this matter of hijab, probably, you know, allowing it or not allowing it or being loose the way they are, and had allowed the Western culture of unbound immorality regarding unhealthy relations of men and women to appear in our society, much opposition from political and non-political spheres in the West would have diminished.
Yeah,
they would have said, okay, now at least they've adopted this idea, leave them alone, you know?
Yeah.
But they are like, what's wrong? And why are these people progressing, yet they are doing this? They just like, I feel they are very jealous. They are very jealous.
Yeah.
Or they have been totally obliterated it.
True. I feel like this is kind of making someone realize that you don't need all of this to survive. I remember when we used to see, you know, movies or when we used to see some documentaries, and they talk about these people who have been, you know, wasting their time by and going to get drunk, and you know, after a hard day's work, they go straight to the pub or something. They just, or they go and watch immoral things. Right now, the Pornhub is like, you feel so
commercialized,
worried, so commercialized, and it's one of the biggest industries right now. So it's very scary. And they feel like, how is it possible that this country is going on without all these distractions? We don't need to, you know, to detoxify ourselves and go home and go get a drink. But they need that to survive. Yeah. So it's very interesting how we work so differently and we are yet thriving
successful.
And
yes.
successful, you know.
Yeah.
So it's very beautiful. Alhamdulillah.
So then he says that, you see, in our country, once the removal of headscarves became obligatory, but no one in the world objected the compulsory removal of hijab. Okay?
Yeah.
In our neighboring country, Turkey, removal of hijab became compulsory. And even until recently, some Turkish governments continued this obligation, as we witnessed examples during the recent years. But nobody on the planet ever objected this move.
Yeah.
So they made it compulsory to remove. We made it compulsory to wear. Again, he says.
Yeah.
More striking than that is what happens in some European countries, which consider themselves as advanced, so-called advanced. Though human rights and public opinion are presented as important in their propagations and claims, in France, human rights are important,
yeah.
he says. But in France, girls are not allowed to go to human rights here, you see? In France, girls are not allowed to go to school whilst wearing headscarves. So why? Where is the freedom there, yeah?
True, yeah.
In this case, compulsion, that is force, is permissible for them.
Yeah.
And they see nothing wrong with it. However, they object the fact that the Islamic Republic has made a modest dress compulsory. So what is the difference, yeah? If there is a problem with forcing women to appear in society with a specific type of clothing, it's worse than compulsory hijab, because wearing hijab is closer to well-being. At least these two obligations must be viewed with equal judgment, he says. But the West does not present this perspective. He says that, no, we have forced, it's okay, but you shouldn't force. You see?
Yeah.
So at least they should view this with justice, yeah? If
True.
They think that, okay, freedom of rights, they make the policies, so...
Yeah, and I think people have this kind of idea in their mind that, you know, Iran is so oppressive and, oh my God, the people of Iran, what are they going through? And those people haven't really even come into Iran to see the situation. They're just seeing based on what the social media is kind of presenting to them. So we were just hearing a lecture a while ago by the speaker who is a German, and he lived in the US and he's come here as a professor, he's a Shia, and he said that his parents were very against him becoming Shia, especially and going to Iran. But he was trying to explain them, but they weren't like understanding, and then they accepted it. But he said the time his mother really accepted it was when she came to Iran and said, oh, I didn't know that the people of Iran were actually living normal lives. We thought they were all oppressed. We thought you are getting oppressed as well. You're being brainwashed. She said that now I understand that they're living like normal people. They're living
and the women
lives.
Too, when they're in the hijab, they're living completely normal lives.
Yeah.
And enjoying, right?
Yeah, it's very beautiful, alhamdulillah. So thank you so much for, you know, your valuable time and your beautiful points. And we hope to see you, inshallah, in the next episode.
Inshallah.
I know I'm
waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, here is a wonderful saying from the Commander of the Faithful and Leader of the Pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The most helpless of all persons is he who cannot find a few brothers during his life. But still more helpless is he who finds such a brother but loses him.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 كتاب
General Haj Qasem Soleimani, it's a name that has long sent shivers down the spine of the world's worst terrorists and their masters in the West Asia region, mainly the Israeli regime and the U.S., and surprisingly enough, continues to do so to this very day. When you get to know about the story of how the gifted general managed to mobilize the population of an entire region to fight against the Israeli occupation and Western imperialism, in the span of less than just 3 decades, you'll better understand why the U.S. decided to murder the general in early 2020, right after he led the fight against Daesh Takfiri terror group to success. General Soleimani was a nightmare for terrorists and their masters. General Soleimani led the elite Quds force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the IRGC, from 1988 up until the time of his assassination. But the fact of the matter is that he was not just an Iranian commander who made certain achievements and left. No, his character and strategy actually turned into a school of thought that is still the driving force behind the regional resistance movement and keeps shaking the foundations of the Israeli occupation and American imperialism even more strongly than before. His school of thought is actually still the driving force, the source of inspiration for the regional resistance axis against Israel. Let's take a quick look at his major achievements in a nutshell. Angered by the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the U.S. and its allies helped provoke an 8-year Iraqi war against the nascent Islamic establishment in the hope of destroying it. That plot, however, went down the drain thanks to the public mobilization and foundation of the IRGC and the brilliant role that its commanders, including General Soleimani, played on the battlefield under the guidance of the late Imam Khomeini. Later on, as part of the ideals of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the IRGC took on a more important role that exceeded the frontiers of Iran, and that was to fight against the main source of instability and insecurity in the broader Muslim region, namely Israel's occupation of Palestine and Western imperialism. When General Soleimani took over the Quds force in 1988, the genius strategist started using his military expertise and brilliant thinking to identify various resistance cells that were created by the people against any compromise with the Israeli regime. He then began establishing links between these various local resistance regional forces and created a network of them, thus giving identity to the ever-growing regional resistance axis that has since been a thorn on the side of the Israeli occupiers and their allies. In Lebanon, one of the pillars of the resistance axis, General Soleimani played a pivotal role in the Hezbollah resistance group's struggle against Israel, especially during the 2006 war, which dealt a heavy blow to the invincibility myth of the Zionist military and humiliated the occupying entity. During the 33-day war, General Soleimani was personally present on the battlefield and offered effective advisory assistance to Hezbollah, Lebanon's de facto military power, enabling the Lebanese to gain new victories years after liberating the southern region in an earlier conflict. Hezbollah has since continued to substantially grow its weapons arsenal,
manpower, and intelligence apparatus. The group is seen as the textbook definition of a hybrid actor with conventional and unconventional warfare capabilities. It has also passed on its military knowledge to other resistance groups in Palestine and Syria as well.
General Soleimani did a similar thing in Palestine. He offered training to the resistance forces and empowered armed struggles against the Israeli regime, especially the ones in the besieged Gaza Strip. Much to the dismay of the Israeli regime, General Soleimani managed to secretly break the tight siege that has been in place against Gaza since 2010 by facilitating the transfer of defense equipment to the different resistance factions there, before they acquired the expertise to develop their own. The Israeli regime has, over the past 13 years, waged several wars on Gaza with the goal of crushing the resistance movement there, but each time the Zionist entity has suffered an even bigger defeat than the last in the face of growing defense capabilities of the Palestinian resistance fighters. Today, the Palestinian resistance is not solely defending the homeland, but it's now on the offensive.
General Soleimani's role in the victories of the Palestinian resistance against Israel better came to light in the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa Storm by Hamas against the occupying entity, which caught the regime's much-boasted spy services and military off guard. Humiliated by the surprise raid, the Israeli military has been conducting a campaign of destruction and ethnic cleansing in Gaza with the goal of, quote-unquote, wiping out Hamas. But it has so far achieved nothing more than the massacre of children and women.
The general, however, rose to global fame due to his crucial role in the Syrian and Iraqi fight against Daesh from 2014 up until late 2017. Daesh was widely known to be a U.S. proxy designed to weaken anti-Israeli resistance in Iraq and Syria. The emergence of the terror group initially shocked the national armies of the two countries. The scary Takfiris then moved to occupy land in the two neighboring states on the back of a campaign of death and destruction. General Soleimani, however, was quick and rushed to the aid of the two countries. He helped the Iraqi and Syrian national armies rebuild strength and also sped up the formation of popular groups to strengthen local militaries in the campaign against Daesh. The commander was present alongside the armies and the local resistance forces all throughout the battles and ultimately led their efforts to victory in late 2017.
General Soleimani's strategies likewise inspired the Yemeni nation, a rather new member but exemplary member of the resistance axis against Israel and the U.S. The world watched in surprise how Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement defeated a Western-backed military campaign against their country by Saudi Arabia and a coalition of its Arab allies with empty hands. In parallel with its defense campaign, the Houthi Ansarullah movement continued to build military strength to the extent that today it is militarily and economically challenging the Zionist regime in solidarity with Palestine.
All in all, what's unique about General Soleimani's strategy is that he detected and tried successfully to minimize the religious, racial, and ideological differences that has long been abused by the global arrogance to spread the seeds of division among regional states and further its own goals. After getting rid of such sources of division, the commander successfully managed to make the local resistance cells join hands and shatter the roots of occupation and colonialism in the region.
Had it not been for the sacrifices of General Soleimani, the formation of the regional resistance axis would not have been possible. Today, the resistance axis led by Iran has been challenging the unipolar system sought by the U.S. in the world. Years ago, when Israel fired even a single bullet in the occupied territories, everyone in the region would grow fearful of the outbreak of a war by the invincible Israeli military. But today, thanks to General Soleimani, everyone has realized that Israel is truly weaker than a spider's web, as put by Hezbollah's leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah.
The U.S. assassinated General Soleimani to stop this trend, but what it failed to understand is that it would never be able to eliminate the school of thought and the legacy that the great martyr of Al-Quds left behind.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brothers, dear sisters, dear listeners of today's special from IRIB English Radio, Salam. Welcome. This is another episode with a new topic that is greed in Islamic point of view. Today, Wednesday. Yes, today is 27th of Jamadi Uthani, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri Calendar, corresponding to the 20th of Day, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri Calendar, and the 10th of January, 2024 of the Christian Gregorian Calendar. Third, this is verse 35 of chapter At-Tawbah from the Holy Quran. We'll listen to it. Then we'll learn more about it.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يوم يحمى عليها في نار جهنم فتكوى بها جباههم وجنوبهم وظهورهم هذا ما كنزتم لأنفسكم فذوقوا ما كنتم تكنزون.
The day when it will be heated in the fire of hell and seared therewith will be their foreheads, their flanks, and their backs. It will be said, "This is what you hoarded for yourself. So taste what you used to hoard."
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The retribution of amassers of wealth. This holy verse points to one of the chastisement of such people in the next world. It is in that situation that the angels of punishment would tell them that is the same thing that they amassed for themselves in the form of treasures and did not spend it for the deprived in the way of Allah. As a result of their deed, they should taste what they used to treasure and find the evil consequence of it. Once more, this verse emphasizes on this fact that the deeds of human beings will not vanish. The deeds of persons will remain for the next world.
Allahumma ya wasi' al-maghfira, yaghfir li, ya Rabb. Allahumma ya wasi' al-rahma, irhamni.
in the Islamic point of view is the topic of this part. Material inclination arises from uncontrollable greed because of the imaginary happiness that it creates. Greed is considered as a factor which brings misery into the lives of men. As a result, man disregards everything and sacrifices all moral traits in this quest towards gathering wealth until finally the feelings of want become rooted deep in his soul. Dr. Schopenhauer said, "It is rather difficult to define the inclination which are related to acquiring wealth because individual satisfaction varies greatly and there is not a defined scale by which people's want can be judged. Some people are satisfied with the small amounts of money that meet their necessities, while others complain about their unhappiness despite their abundant wealth."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today we are going to talk about greed and its consequences from an Islamic point of view. Imam Baqir alayhi salam gave the following description of the greedy man. An example of the greedy man of this world is that of the silkworm. The more silk that is spins around itself, the less of a chance it has to survive until it finally suffocates itself. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, "Refrain from greed, for those who were before you perished as a result of greed. Greed commanded them to be stingy and they obeyed. It ordered them into alienation and they obeyed. And it commanded them to sin and they sinned." Imam Ali alaihi salam pointed out the misery which results from coveting when he said, "Avoid greed, for its champion is the chapter of humiliation and exhaustion." Wealth is not everything in man's life, nor does his real happiness lie in collecting money. Nevertheless, many young people make the mistake of believing that money is the most important matter in life. They therefore waste the primes of their life seeking wealth while depriving themselves of everything else. This is a very mistaken way of thinking, and it is one of the reasons behind many people's miseries. We struggle to acquire grand clothes and etc., thinking that they are the ways to happiness, while in fact they only bring disappointment and deprivation to us.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the infallibles, lessons from the life of the infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
And the continuation of today's special, what makes greedy people greedy? One of the factors is lack of self-esteem. Lack of self-esteem is the main contributor to greed. When you don't feel good about yourself, you constantly turn to other people to make you feel better. It is an unusual emotion that can only exist in people who are unable to recognize and value what they already have in life, but constantly seek more. This is why they are always searching for ways to get more, so they can contribute to get more things and live as they want. It can be rooted in a fear of not having enough. This might be due to a lack of self-esteem or a fear of not being good enough. Greedy people may also have a compulsive need to acquire and possess things as a way of filling in inner emptiness or seeking validation.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake.
inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The answer of this question is very important: how to avoid greed. One of the answers will be trying to volunteer or give back in some way. Volunteering is a great way to give back and make a difference in your community. It's also a great way to help others, which helps you feel good about yourself and gives you a sense of purpose. Volunteering can be done through volunteer work at home or abroad, or through helping out with an organization that supports the needs of others outside the scope of your own interests, like animal shelters. You may meet new people who share similar interests as yours, and if not, it's always from just getting involved with something. You can learn new skills like cooking, sewing, or gardening that will come in handy later on down the road.
Now, there's a famous hadith during the time of Prophet Isa, Jesus, that one day he was walking with three of his disciples, companions, and they reached a tree. So then he told them, under this tree there is death. He said, what does he mean, death? They searched, they dug a little, they found treasures, gold. They're like, what does this guy mean, Isa, there's death? This is life, this is not death, right? Gold. So they were three people. Isa said, I'm going to go do something and I'll come back in a couple of hours. So there are three. One of them went to sleep. Two of them were alive. They're like, you know what? We're three people and there's this much amount of gold. If we kill this third guy, right? If we kill this third guy, then we can have all the money for ourselves. Us too. Like, less people to share the gold with. So they liked the idea. So he woke up. He said, I'm going to go get some food for us. So as he was getting the food, they conspired that when he comes, we take the food, we kill him, and we share the gold just between us. Now, what did this guy think? As he was going to get the food, he's like, you know what? If all this gold is just for me, that's much better. I don't have to share it with these two people. So he put some poison in that food. He brought it, yalla, let's eat. As soon as he got there, they took the food, and then they killed him. They sat down. And to sit and eat the food. They ate the food with the poison, they fell and died. All three of them died fighting over that gold. Isa comes back, he sees his three companions are dead and the gold is untouched. So he revives them. Remember, the Quran says Isa was given a power, a miracle, that he could revive the dead. So he revived them. He told them, didn't I tell you that this is death, this will kill you? That money will kill you, gold will kill you? Why didn't you listen to me? And they said, yes, we should have known better.
And that was all, of course, for this episode of today's special, which we start under the title of greed in Islamic point of view. Inshallah, we continue to know about this topic more and more. Till then, we leave you in Allah's blessings and have a nice time.
Favors increasing in their flavors, we
turn to you in sheer delight, for truth never strong to fight.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.